Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by OSKA Wellness. That's OSKAWellness.com. Cool new product for pain relief. Our Catalina Eco Marathon, runcatalina.com, that's coming up on Saturday, November 19th. The Challenged Athletes Foundation, we've raised over $75 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on iTunes or on babbittville.com, and you can also subscribe to our newsletter there. We've had over 1 million downloads of our shows. Our next guest, Mr. Todd Jacobson. Todd, longtime pro triathlete. Eighth in Kona a couple of times. Now he's been working with motocross and supercross athletes. Todd, been way too long, bud. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Bob. It was cool to run into you the other day.
It really was, man. I hadn't seen you forever, and you were always one of my favorite interviews. We always had a lot of fun going way back. So when did you find the sport of triathlon? Were you more of a runner?
I was a runner. I think I came to it the way a lot of people did, or I would think a lot of people did. I was a hardcore runner, got injured.
Yep.
Had to find some alternative activities while I was healing, and that would be swimming and cycling are two of the big aerobic monsters that you can do to supplement.
Yeah.
And then I'll tell you what, there was one seminal moment. It was Outside Magazine featuring John Howard, Kathleen McCartney, and Scott Tinley. I think it was 1982.
Yep.
I saw this article. That's when I first learned about Ironman.
And now, where were you living?
I was in Virginia, finishing school at George Mason University, and literally couldn't swim 25 yards. Like, if I was in the deep end, well, I had to get in the shallow end, okay? I stood up one day and said, I'm going to do Ironman. Went to the pool the next day, could not. I swam 15 yards and had to stand up.
And did a coach on the deck go, you want to
do
what? No,
four or five people dove in to save my ass. It was not good. And I'm not a whole hell of a lot better now.
Oh, that is so funny. So did you pack up and move to San Diego and start training with the big boys?
I had to finish my degree.
Yep.
And then I wanted to go somewhere warm year-round. And my dad was in the military, and he was separated from my mom. I was living with my mom and sister, finished school in Virginia. Dad was in El Paso, Texas.
Oh, yeah.
He said, hey, that's really nice. Little did I know that it's high mountain desert, windy, hot as hell. I mean, it was really good training for Kona. It made Kona look like botanical garden. So I went out there and hung out in El Paso, and I got about as good as I could get by myself.
Yes.
You know, I what did I do? I think I got top 5 or 7 in Hilton Head. I got a top 10 in Hawaii, but I needed to come out here and take some clues, you know, success leaves clues, and I wanted to come out here and hang around guys like Mark and
Tinley,
Scott.
And Molina,
and it turns out I ended up training tens of thousands of miles with ST. We got pretty close.
Yeah.
But I needed to come out here and plug into the synergy of and just learn, you know. There's so much to learn being around the best guys.
Here you'd been reading about Tinley and folks like that in Outside Magazine, and next thing you know, you're out here training on a daily basis. Were you, like, sort of pinching yourself going,
actually, Scott ST was one of my initial heroes.
Yeah.
Of course, Dave Scott, too, and Mark Allen and Molina, the big four. How could you not look up to them? And Scott and I have a sort of a same kind of off-camber sarcasm, and we got along pretty good and shared a lot of miles. And, yeah, I did had to pinch myself. But a funny thing happened that I still teach athletes who I work with today. You need to get close to your adversaries because it humanizes them. If you keep them over there and they're just a mystery, you tend to build them up more than they really are. If you're ever going to beat them, you kind of need to humanize them and get near them and find out that they're just like you, you know?
That's a really good point. So,
except for Grip. He ain't like us, and I never beat him.
So, when you talk about Mark Allen, because there was a mystique to Mark where people would train with him and just go, man, that guy's just different. He's just wired different.
Well, I remember one time ST goes, don't get too close to him. He'll take your energy.
Yeah, he'll suck the energy right out of you, right?
Yeah.
And he does.
I don't know. You know, I mean, there's probably some validity to that. If you're feeling that inside, then maybe that's happening. But Mark was just an intensely focused guy, and I think he, like Paula, was became the very best because he became an absolute expert about himself.
Right.
He knew exactly what he needed to do, and he did it.
What
and that was that simple, but that difficult.
What did you learn? Paul Newby Frazier and Scott Tinley and Scott Molina and Mark Allen. What did you learn from those folks that you use with the athletes? And talk a little bit about the athletes you train now.
Well, I just learned old school work ethic from those guys. You know, what's funny is about all us triathletes, we didn't need a lot of motivation and training. We didn't need anybody to wake us up and put foot to ass to get outside and work. We just did that.
Right.
So I've heard Molina, speak of it as well. Just the old school blue collar work ethic.
Yeah.
Mike Pig, they all had it. Everyone had it. That's what I love about triathlon is the best guy does win.
Yes. Yeah.
And you can't fake it. You don't get lucky for 9 hours. I mean, you've got to work. And that's what I learned from that. And mostly the way I'm able to help a lot of other athletes, which I'll get to some of those guys, but I can impart on them some wisdom I learned mostly from my mistakes, not my successes. I really do believe there's a bit more to learn from failing, for lack of a better term. That's a harsh term. I thought I was a second tier, but top end second tier guy.
Right.
I was somebody that, you know, those top guys needed to beat to be who they were. I was always given it hell, top tens, and I won a few majors, but I'm cool with it. I feel good. I see where I came up short. I see where I sold myself short. And that's really the essential lesson I get to with some of the kids I work with is there's going to be these moments of truth where you can either sell yourself short and back off, or you can push through. You can shrink from the moment or you can get after it. And I shrunk from it a lot of times and sort of sold myself short and just thought that, well, I don't have a chance against these guys. And, you know, I really did, but I didn't. You know, I didn't think I did. So that's one of the lessons I've taken over. And I've worked with a lot of action sports athletes. Ironically, it has nothing to do with endurance, although we all end up riding bikes and all of them want to do Ironman now. I guess it must be an infection.
Yeah.
But, some of the notables who are supercross champions like Jeremy McGrath and Ernesto Fonseca, who's now in a wheelchair because of a bad accident, but he's competing in Rio in the Paralympics in the 400 meters.
Very proud
of him.
Yeah.
David Bailey, of course, who's a real legend, and he was a legend on the motorcycle and an even bigger legend off. And Travis Pastrana, who's probably, that would be a whole separate party, Bob. We should have a whole other interview about him. He's a real interesting cat, and I've learned a lot from him and taught him a lot, but he's come to the point now, if his knees weren't so bad, he'd like to go to Kona, and he wants to do Ram. And it's crazy how this whole, he's very interested or infatuated with the limits of endurance.
Right.
But he's an action sports athlete, and his events take fractions of a second. And it's really interesting how he's sort of been enthralled with that.
So when you say you shrunk from the moment, give me an example of where you felt like, looking back on it, you know what, that was an opportunity for me and I didn't take it.
In Hawaii, I was a weaker swimmer, I keep telling everybody if I could swim well, I'd have a bigger house, you know. But so there's about 800 to 1,000 meters in Hawaii where you need to get on the bus.
Right.
Or you've missed the bus.
Right.
And I mean, when you miss that bus, you've missed it all day. Because it's going to be very hard to pull time back out of the very best aerobic machines on the planet.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they're gonna ride worse than you are.
Bob, I have actually even split Mark at other races and been third or fourth. You know, I mean, that doesn't take anything from Mark. I did okay on the bike and the run, but man, it's three sports. It's a triathlon.
You got to be there.
A running race. Yeah. You got to have your nose at the front in order to win.
Right.
How did I shrink from it?
Yeah.
I just didn't have enough belief in myself to actually roll the dice. In other words, you need to be willing to lose to win.
You do. Yeah.
And what you need to do over there, if you're a little bit weaker swimmer, in theory, well, not actually in practice, you can swim on the tail end of a pack that's 30% faster than you if you can make the break.
If you,
800 to 1,000 meters of pure anaerobic hell, deltoids blowing up, arms blowing up. You're thinking you could possibly ruin your whole race in the first 10 minutes. But if you can get on that pack, it's a whole nother event.
Yes. Yeah.
Like it's a whole nother race, a whole nother area code. And I oftentimes just pulled back out of that. Similar to the way Pauly Kiru lost that race because he's looking at his heart rate monitor.
Right. Yeah.
Self-imposed limit, some sort of intellectual limitation that he just put on himself. Meanwhile, I asked Tinley about that one day. He goes, I don't give a shit. I'll go to 300 beats per minute to win. Okay, I don't care about that, whatever it takes to win. So that's kind of what I did sometimes.
Yeah.
But, I did the work. I did the work day in and day out with the top guys. I knew what it took. I was willing to do what it took. Well, that's a huge step. Everybody talks a big game, but not everybody's willing to do all the work. So I did all the work, but...
But on race
kind of
day,
always just gave those guys a bit more postage than I should. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know what? I remember Molina telling me he'd be at a race, and he had just done Ragbra or something. He'd done like a 400-mile week. And guys would catch him on a bike because he's a little toasted, and they wouldn't go by. Because it's almost like, well, wait a second. I'm with Molina. He's going to win the race. I'm in the right place. So they were intimidated to go by a guy because of his reputation.
I remember the first time I caught and passed Dave Scott, and it was in a USGS race in Houston, and I actually deliberated or debated whether I should pass the dude.
Yeah, right. Because you're thinking, well, that's Dave Scott. Right. I'm not good enough to go by him.
That's Dave Scott. Now, he can't possibly be having a bad day, so I'm going way too hard. You know, you just, all that self-talk, it can either be really positive or really negative, and that's when you get into shrinking from the moment.
Right.
How you talk to yourself, what's going on in your helmet is critical. And that's an awful loud committee in there sometimes, you know?
So talk a little bit about when David Bailey, we talk about motocross world champion, and we talk about him getting paralyzed in the mid-80s when he was making, what, 750K a year? He's the best in the world. And we set up this trio of races between the motocross world champion and with Carlos Maleda, this badass Navy SEAL who was shot in the back down in Panama and came back to do triathlon. And so when David first, did you know David when he was a motocross guy, or did you meet him afterwards?
I love David. So
yeah.
He's a rock star.
Totally.
I'm a triathlete.
Yep.
Making 40 grand a year. Not complaining. It's
no.
Top ramen, but I love it. Right?
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
cool. David's a rock star.
Yep.
Ironically, he picked, and he loved triathlon.
Yes.
He wanted to be a triathlete.
No question.
But he had to race, he raced motorcycles, and it was easy for him, he said.
Yeah.
He said that was just easy because it was so innate. It was a talent. I mean, he lived on talent. He worked hard, and he was smart, but he was really talented. And in a way, he said he felt kind of guilty because it was so easy for him. But anyway, he always had his eye on this triathlon thing over here. And I don't know why, but he kind of picked me out. I mean, he's shown me pictures of me in scrapbooks. He just liked me for some reason. I'm back there in eighth, man. But
yeah.
He liked me for some reason. So I always admired him. A lot more people knew him than knew me.
Right.
But David kind of liked me.
And then,
I got hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
We ended up at No Fear together.
Oh, that's right. You're working No Fear together. Okay.
Right. We ended up sitting next to each other at a desk learning how to design stuff to kind of put us in charge of designing cycling gear and driving gear, gloves and shoes for top drivers. And
right.
And Dave just, and I'm trying to decompress and actually come off an addiction called triathlon because I got hurt and I couldn't do it. And I'm
right.
in a real job. And all he did was talk about Ironman all day.
Driving
all
you crazy.
Day. Yeah. And then finally going, look, dude, let's just go do one so you'll shut up. And they have the Carlsbad race here. And I'll teach you how to swim, and I'll carry you in and out of there and throw your butt in a bike, and we'll just get this done, okay? And then after you do that, and I didn't say this, but I knew, after you do that, you won't want to talk about Ironman. Because this will be enough. You'll get a snoot full of this, and that'll be enough for you. It wasn't. It was just led to more. And long story short, we ended up going and doing Ironman. And in David's case, he's my best friend, and I realized during that journey that it was kind of his return to actually living.
Right.
Because there were some times when Dave kind of was asking for the check, you know?
Right.
I need the check, I'm paid and be done.
Yeah.
And that wasn't lost on me, so I kind of, and I didn't know all this at the time. The way it was unfolding was really poetic and cool, but I didn't know that. I just wanted to help him. So I dedicated several years to helping him do that race, and then thankfully for him, this worthwhile adversary materialized named Carlos Molina, who's just sort of, you know, there's Indian cultures that pray for enemies because they keep you strong. I mean, he had this adversary that just really made sense. It defined Dave's purpose. And we launched into that, and Dave lost to him a couple times, and as opposed to it scarring him mentally and making him shrink from it, he rose up to it,
really
did even more. That's a whole other interview, actually, what we did for that and that journey. And then Dave, you know, did really well, so I'm extremely proud of that.
The coolest thing was, you know, we first tried to get wheelchair guys to be able to do Kona. Originally, Iron Man was concerned because they're like, hey, if we change the way you ride a bike with a hand cycle and do the run with a racing chair, you know, what happens if somebody, does this open up Pandora's box and some guy shows up with a windsurfer and says, hey, I can't swim, I want to use a windsurfer? And we're like, no, you got to come up with real rules. So Dr. John Franks didn't make the cutoff time in 94, and then in a hand cycle. Then John McClain came over in, you know, in actually 95, 96 and didn't make it.
We watched him finish in 97.
Yeah,
Dave and I took
first
a trip
time
over there just to recon, a little bit of recon, and that's what made this all so, okay, it's doable.
Yeah, so John finally made all the cutoff times, and then David goes to Lubbock in Buffalo Springs. That was a qualifier, right? Now, you were with him that year, that first year.
Oh, we drove to Lubbock, right?
You guys drove?
Hottest time of the year, hottest place in the country. As soon as you cross those mountains east of El Cajon, you drop down into the desert, and the whole world changes.
Yeah.
We reached for the air conditioner and looked at each other and said, no.
What?
No air conditioning all the way. I go, hey, Dave, you need to acclimate.
How committed are you? Are you
in? We were soaking wet.
Oh,
we had the windows
up.
It was hilarious. It was actually macabre.
How many hour drive is this?
It's like 16.
With no air. With the windows up, because
on purpose.
So meanwhile, you're going there and basically depleting, right? He's going to be depleting.
Yeah, but when we got there, I set up 3 gallon jugs of water and some electrolyte stuff, and said, by tonight, I need all this gone.
Wow.
He's going, yeah, but I'm going to have to piss like Secretary at the Preakness. I go, I understand that, but you're going to saturate, and we're going to get you.
We got to recover. Yeah.
And we didn't use air conditioning in the room. And he didn't know who Carlos was.
Of course, yeah.
So he didn't actually respect him.
Right.
Well, it's kind of like the bumblebee. Aerodynamically, they're not sound. They shouldn't fly, but the bee doesn't know it, so he does it anyway. Dave didn't know, so he just went ahead and put it to Carlos. They got off the bike very close, and there's this huge hill about 2 miles into the run, and I was there with Dave on my bike going, first guy at the top of this hill is going to win this race.
Right.
And he did, and it was amazing. See, Carlos went home, though, put David's picture on the fridge, and went full-on Rocky Balboa on Dave. And when they got to Kona that year, he killed him, and he killed him the next year. But, by the way, on the way back from Lubbock, we get in the car,
he
reaches for the air conditioner, we look at each other, shake our head no, and we drove back.
And so, really, David wins, and I'm sure he thinks, okay, I've got this race in the bag in Kona, I'm going to go home and refine. And Carlos went home and went to work.
No, Dave's coming home designing his clothing and stuff. He wants, because Dave's very stylish.
Yeah, yeah.
How's my bike going to look for this? I need a cool helmet. Which Oakleys? Which lenses are going to look best with this kit, Todd? I'm going, meanwhile, Carlos, right?
Yeah.
He's eating dirt clods. And, right?
He's got David's picture up. And he's going, I'm taking this guy down.
And he did.
Yeah. And the following year as well.
He did it so soundly that David was almost spooked by it.
Yeah.
And then the third time, I got tired of hearing all that, and I go, Dave, you need to pivot and run right back at the dog that's chasing you. You need to walk right into the darkness of these fears, face it, shake hands with it, mark it with Dave, realize you're going to have this guy with you all day, and you got to figure out a way to beat them. You need to get comfortable with that. You're going to have to forward your mail to a real ugly place. You're going to have to learn how to suffer. This guy ain't going to wilt, ain't going to shrink, and he ain't going to quit. He won't lose. You have to beat him. There's a big difference between losing and getting beat. Losing is underperforming for any number of reasons, but getting beat is when you throw your best stuff down and the other guy beats you. That's cool. You shake his hand. It's not fun, but it's okay. There's honor in that.
So
I said, that's how he's going to get beat. He ain't going to lose.
So basically, David had to, post a photo of Carlos around the house and just go, okay, this is the guy,
well,
and I got to beat him.
I said that. I said, put one straight above your bed, put it on the fridge, put it in the bathroom. Just get okay with this dude.
Yeah.
Okay? But I don't know if he did that, but Dave is a real cerebral, hyper-intelligent athlete and person. And he understood that, and he took that intellectual idea and really internalized it, and he understood that. And he started doing things. He took it even further. Like, he would go out and bonk on purpose.
Right.
Now, you don't want to do that. Well, here's a guy, when he was racing motocross, most guys, when they're riding and it starts raining, they pack up and go home.
Right.
I mean, that's hard on the bikes. It's easy to get hurt. Doesn't make any sense. Meanwhile, Dave goes, hey, you know what? We race in the rain. So he'd wait for it to rain and then go out and do motos.
Yeah.
So he was real familiar with how to prepare. So he actually put himself through serious bonks to see if he could recover, even knowing you can't really let it go that far. If you get behind on the fluids and the nutrition in Hawaii, you're done.
Right. What was
I mean, you'll recover. You might finish, but it's not optimal. You're going to lose.
When Mark was trying to beat Dave, and he kept doing, basically he would own Dave in Nice or anywhere else, but he was doing six-hour training days. The big difference between all the other years in 1989, he was doing those longer training days. And I think I remember David's wife, Gina, saying that she'd come home and Dave would be passed out leading in the 2000.
Well, that was the seminal lesson I learned from Mark myself.
Yeah.
Mark one day looks at me and goes, you know what? Anybody can do a six-hour day. But how long is Kona?
Yeah.
It's a whole different metabolism, and it's a whole different mental landscape. He goes, I don't care how you construct it. You can go swim an hour, ride six, run two. You can go not swim, ride nine. You can ride six, run three. But you have got to be training that long in order to create the training effect and the adaptation you're going to need to race and not survive Kona, Bob, race Kona.
Right.
And that's the same thing I imparted on Dave, and that's what made all the difference.
So I remember David telling me when he came to Kona, he's like, listen, I'm going to try to stay away from Carlos. I don't really want to see the guy. And I think the first person he saw when he rolled into the King Cam Hotel was Carlos Maleda.
Well, I mean, that's just poetic, Bob. Those two were on a collision course. It's the way it is.
Yeah.
I liked the way they treated each other. I thought they competed with honor.
Yes.
I thought it took the game to a whole new level. It was kind of strange. I knew it was a disability situation, so all the eyes were on the able body. But I thought one of the best races ever that occurred over there was Dave and Carlos. Obviously, Mark and Dave. There's been some epic battles over there that everyone saw. But what those two guys did was really seminal in my mind. It epitomized a lot of what Ironman is about, what it means to people, and how you can return, how you heal things. I mean, it was a really big day. When Dave actually scooped up everything he had and took all the bad shit and focused that in one moment in the run, which is a push for him, and was able to put that down on the pavement and catch that guy and win, that was, Dave said it's the best thing he ever did.
No question.
And he's won some big stuff.
Yeah.
And he goes, that's still the best thing he'd ever done.
Well,
so,
I've watched video of Anaheim. I watched
very
Anaheim fun. Stadium with him and Ricky Johnson. That was a classic day. But there was it's funny because leading into that race, I told Carlos, I just thought it was going to be close. And he was like, Bob, it's going to be over on the first hill. But there was something about that race between those two guys, it made disability disappear. It was just two great athletes who wanted to kick the other guy's ass. And
I think what
the
we
chair
were looking at,
went away.
I, Bob, I'm sitting in my garage, and I have this really, like, six-foot poster. Well, you actually have the same image down at CAF.
Yes,
okay?
Of David.
I got that right here.
Yep.
Dave refuses to sign it because he says, I'm scared. I don't even know what to say. He won't sign it for 10 years. But anyway, that's that was just, there isn't a chair there. You're looking at a will. You're looking at ambition. You're looking at raw will and intent. He just happens to be dragging all that stuff with him, you know, a chair or whatever it is. This is one soul just pushing down the highway, getting it done.
What I loved was, you know, interviewing David later and him saying that, you know, during the week, and you were probably with him, he was doing his last push, and he came to the top of the energy lab and was like,
typical Dave.
Yeah,
typical
I don't really want to go in here right now, but I know this 4 miles probably will decide the race, and I need to know every inch, every pebble on this in the energy lab. And that's sort of exact. I remember also he was coming through town. It was his mom's birthday, and he's, you know, he had flatted, so he's a little behind Carlos coming through town early in the marathon, and his mom and Gina are giving him the golf clap. The good try, honey. You're gonna lose again.
Right.
And then the next thing you know, going in the energy lab, I think he was maybe 30 seconds, 40 seconds down, and coming out, they were basically together.
Yeah, he told me he just found a way to take all the stuff.
Yeah.
The bad stuff. I hate to say it, but it's true. You find a lot more power and strength in anger.
Right.
Than you do love. So he had a lot to be pissed about. And he took all that and honed it and put it to the pavement. And it was really cool. I mean, it was really, really cool. I thought I was very, very proud to be part of that. I mean, it made me forget all about an injury that made me retire early. And it made me forget all about, I mean, I felt like I'd come full circle. I didn't even ever need to go do that race again. How could I ever do anything better than what I helped him do?
Was it hard for you to go back there after, you know, because obviously your career did end early because of an injury, and I'm sure that was a place that, you know, you had finished eighth a couple times. You sort of had a little unfinished business
there. I kind of lost the top three once to a mechanical. I mean, I tell people I had my best and worst days of my life on that highway.
Yeah.
I think I've raced, I don't know, 1,500 miles on that road. You know, I mean, that's just this one place on the planet. There's a lot of people that can say that. It's a very magical, important place. But when I went back with Dave in 97 to watch McLean finish, I had a little bit of that. But when I went back with Dave, I was cool with it.
You were on a mission. You were on a partnership.
I was cool with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really, really cool with it. I feel so good about being able to do something even bigger than just for me. Because, Bob, actually being a pro triathlete is a pretty selfish pursuit.
It is. I know.
It's quite OCD and a little bit vain and very selfish, and which is cool, but you can't do it your whole life.
No.
I think you need to grow, and you need... See, I didn't even know what Ironman meant. I just knew I needed to do a certain performance in order to maintain good standing with sponsors, earn some prize money, and be able to race again the next year. And there were so many other reasons for doing it, and there were so many other byproducts of Ironman, and it means so much, many different things to so many people. And I saw what it did for Dave, and it kind of opened my eyes. It kind of made me grow up a little bit, you know? There's more to it than just my swim split, you know? So.
Well, one of the things that I think, again, is universal is when David finished, and we, you know, we got Gina in the finish area there, and he had won the race. I remember even a mile 22, that photo is around mile 22, and the tears are flying, and, you know, David is in full, on the racing chair, just full out. He had just passed Carlos, and obviously he's going to win the race. But when he came across the line, rather than going to massage, he's like, no, I need to wait for Carlos. And I watched him. And they have those grimy gloves, right, that they use for cheer. And they touch gloves, and I could see that they embrace. And David says something to Carlos. So as we're rolling away, I said to Carlos, I said, what did he say to you? And he goes, he said, thank you. And I was like, what? And he goes, yeah, that's what I said back. I said, what? He goes, thank you for pushing me to a level I never would have reached on my own. And that, to me, goes way beyond wheelchairs, way beyond racing chairs and hand cycles. It's about, again, the respect that you have as an athlete for someone similar to Mark and Dave who push you to a level you would not have reached without that other person.
Really, Bob, Dave's awesome, but what is Dave without Mark?
Exactly.
And what is Mark without Dave?
Right. Yeah. And what is
Paula without Aaron? I mean, you've got to beat somebody really good.
Right, right.
And they did. Yeah,
well, and you know, I always tell people, because, you know, Mark had lost to Dave how many different times? And then in 88, Dave was out with a bad knee, and Mark flattered a couple times. Because if he had won that day without Dave there, it wouldn't have meant anything. But by winning the following year, when Dave, whose course record was 8:28, and he went 8:10 that day, ran 2:41, and Mark, like you mentioned earlier, Mark won the race. He beat the guy on the greatest day he ever had.
And Dave did not lose.
No.
Dave got beat.
Right.
That speaks back to what I was saying. And
yes.
I know that bothered the hell out of Dave.
Oh, big time.
But he still was able to hold his head up.
Well, and Dave was funny because he said his classic line was, and we were like, you know, he goes, I don't feel like I lost. I feel like I ran out of time.
Yeah, like we need that race longer.
We do. Like, it needs to be 27 miles. It needs
if
to be 30 miles.
If you can't settle this out in 140.6, we got a problem.
Exactly. The other race that I always associate you with, 1990 Ironman, probably, you know, we had, obviously, 89 was a very fast year, broke the course record, 809, 810. And there's something about that island when things seem to be going well and people start predicting their times and thinking that the wind is and heat are something manageable. Then you have a year like 1990 where the heat was just oppressive. And, you know, our boy Scott Tinley, who was way off the back, off the bike, just ran through the carnage. And you summed that up so perfectly. You saw that happening. What were your thoughts when you saw ST?
Well, first of all, Matt and Pele has ears. You never talk crap over there.
No, ever.
You don't ever try to talk crap. You don't act any more than you are. You actually should just be quiet. Don't take anything from that place and just pray for safe passage.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
But, it was a brutal year. And Mark's coming back to defend. I'd been training with ST. Actually, we thought it was too cool here on the coast. We wear sweatshirts and ride, you know.
Really?
Julian, yeah.
And you guys are nuts.
Scott is just tough, Bob. Yeah. Not to take from Scott because I have nothing but admiration and respect for him, but clinically, his numbers are not that gnarly.
No.
His VO, he's not that, but his will, he's a bit like Travis.
Right.
From the neck up, once he invests, emotionally, look out. And Sky just realized that ST could race in hell.
Right.
And do well.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like, you go better in the heat, you go better in the wind. You just slow down less.
Right.
And Scott didn't slow down much at all.
He just ran through everybody.
He's just tough, man. That guy could go to that real ugly place where you're coughing up a lung and suffering and spitting and snarling and just stay there for hours.
And I remember Mark, people would, you know, come up on him, and the only thing he said was, "Where's Tinley?"
And Mark was the opposite. He trained so hard because he did not like to suffer to that extent in a race.
Right.
He did not.
Yes.
Mark trained to win.
Right.
And Scott, we were a little bit more free-spirited. We did some dumb stuff. I mean, we didn't always have our nose to the grindstone. We had some fun out there.
Right.
But when it was race day, he was all in. Mark, super prepared, didn't want to suffer as much, but meanwhile, here's ST, who was willing to suffer pretty much. He pretty much pushed all in on a race. He could.
Always.
He really could.
Yeah.
And
what were some, give me an example of some fun times you had with Tinley.
Just the training miles, mostly. And we'd screw with each other a lot. It got so bad we had to come up with rules. Okay, you can't mess with the guy while he's sleeping. Because, on a plane ride home from Japan Ironman, when your quads are shot, you see the other guy doze off, you punch him in the quad. Something like that.
Yeah.
Can't mess with his food because, you know, you get up to go to the bathroom, come back, and somebody rubbed the jalapeno all over your glass edge and burns your lip. Can't do that. Can't mess with their equipment. I put on my shoes in transition, peanut butter and jelly. Right?
No way.
Yeah, so you can't do that. We just had a lot of fun. We just kind of meshed because we kind of were just jokers.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of fun. We worked really hard. That's just the balance. I mean, I've read some Tinley interviews where, you know, he would say how serious Dave is, how serious Mark is. But Scott always had this spice of unpredictable fun to him.
Right.
And that's kind of what drew me to him and kind of why we got along.
When you look back at your career as a triathlete, what was the best race you ever had? Or one, the one that meant the most to you?
88, when Mark had all his troubles.
Yeah.
On the way out, I had my usual bad swim, like 56 minutes. So that's 5 minutes back of the real race. 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's a long way.
You give good guys on bikes 5 minutes, you can't even see them.
Right.
So, and it's not like they're going to slow down.
No.
So.
Yeah.
But I was having a great day, and I was riding up into that. And on the way out, I started, some of the spokes on my minimal spoke front wheel started unthreading and coming loose, and the wheel was getting out of true. And that was one of the first years we had Shimano support on the course.
Yeah.
So I pulled over, and I'm already up in the top 10, Bob, early. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
I'm ahead of a lot of guys who used to always have to catch in the run, so I know I'm having a good day, and I'm being cool about it and being calm. I wait, and the guy turns my bike upside down. He's truing the wheel. I'm absolutely can't even take it. He goes, "You need to go stand over there." True the wheel back up. I get up to Javi, make the turn, come down. We're going about, what, 50, usually 55?
Yep.
These folks start coming out again and wrapping around the forks.
Oh, my God.
I'm looking down at the front wheel going, I'm going to be riding the forks soon. I have to stop or I'm going to actually get hurt. Stopped again, waited 11 minutes for a wheel.
Oh.
11 minutes.
Oh.
I came into trend. I'm having the race of my life, really. I really am. I'm really prepared. I overtrained, but I actually absorbed it. I was ready. And I sat in a folding chair in transition and kind of started crying and being soft and gathered myself and put on my shoes and ran like a 250, by my watch, 250-something.
Yeah.
You know, but that count, you're sitting there in the chair crying, counts as my run split. And then I ran myself back up to 8.
Wow.
You know, that's not such a big deal, but to me, that was the kind of the best day I had. I've won other races and wildflower and cool races, but
right.
Gathering it back up and getting back out there. You know what I consider that, though? Sportsmanship.
Yeah.
You actually, you can't act like that. You've got to try to finish. I mean, that's the only race on the whole planet that I put a premium on finishing. And you've seen Jurgen Zach come in and, you know.
Molly Kiru.
Yeah.
Yeah, all those guys, yep.
I respect that.
I do, too.
I really respect that.
Yeah.
You kind of got to finish that race.
Yeah, you don't. That's not one you just go, okay, I'm. Because that's your A race, and if you're not having a good day, the typical thing is, well, I'll go to Arizona in a couple months. But, you know, you...
No, that's not a disposable. I think it sticks with you. And I remember talking to my mom later about, I was very happy I did that. I mean, I could look at it one way, or I could look at it another. 8, really disappointing. Look what I lost, look what I could have done, or look what you did. I mean, look what you did with a bad hand of cards.
Right.
Okay, so that's the real lesson, and I think that just carries on further. It's not about sport; it's about your attitude and how you approach things in life. And that was a good move. So that's my answer to that.
So, out of all the people you work with over the years, David Bailey is right at the top of the list. I'm imagining.
Well, our friendship—we don't even—we have our own language. We're so close. So yeah, nothing really touches that. But Travis is.
Pretty special.
Much, and I'm godfather to his youngest daughter. We've been together 14 years. I'm going to write a book about my times with him what's gone on with him and what he does. The real inside story on him is amazing.
He just seems like such a special man.
A good
everything
man.
You read, yeah.
Find somebody who doesn't like him. Find somebody who's
nobody.
Not a fan. You think it's cliche. Is that really how he is? Yeah, it's really how he is. You know, so I'm very fortunate to have friends like that. Dave and Travis are like, you know, that the friends you can count on one hand. Those are two of them right there. So I'm very fortunate.
Love it. Hey, Todd, thanks as always. It's been a long time since we chatted, but I it's always so much fun talking to you because you bring such a great attitude to the table when it comes to, your career was cut short. You were one of the top guys over in Kona and, you know, you rolled. You know, obviously, I wasn't there when you're going through your challenges, but the fact that you were able to roll from that and really help David Bailey make a dream come true. I mean, that 3 year, that trilogy between him and Carlos Moleta that's movie material. That's something that
Bob. Yeah. I learned a valuable lesson. You heal by helping.
You
Sometimes
do.
When you think you need, no, you need to give.
That is a
it's
great
crazy,
point. It's
but
true.
It helped.
It's really true. You were the man, Todd. Thank you so much for taking so much time.
Hey, thank you, Bob. My pleasure as always.
Todd Jacobs has been our guest. Again, we were brought to you by OscaWellness.com. We're on Catalina.com. Our Catalina Inco Marathon coming up on Saturday, November 19th. Challenged Athletes Foundation. We have raised over $75 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on iTunes or on Babbittville.com. Definitely subscribe to our newsletter. And until next time, remember, endurance lives here.